1969 is going to be one of those dates which schoolboys will always be able to remember, like 55 BC when the Romans first set foot in Britain, or 1492 when Christopher Columbus discovered the Americas. 1969 was the year that man landed on the moon.
60 seconds. Lights on. Down 2.5. Forward. Forward. Dust. 30 feet down, 2.5. Picking up some dust. 30 feet, 2.5 down. Great shadow. 4 forward. 4 forward, drifting to the right a little. Ready? Down and a half. 30 seconds. Forward. Dust. Ready? Contact light. Okay, engine stop. ATA at a descent. Boat control, both auto descent, engine command override off. Engine arm off. 413 is in.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
But if the Americans seemed to be taking giant steps forward in 1969, we in Britain were plunged into a past which we had hoped was long dead and forgotten. In October, British troops and policemen came under rifle fire in British streets. Conflict in Northern Ireland had its origins in past history, present-day politics, and religion. The dispute was crystallized in the persons of Ian Paisley, the fighting Protestant, and one of the most passionate and controversial personalities of 1969, Bernadette Devlin, elected in April as Member of Parliament for Mid-Ulster, the youngest MP at Westminster for 50 years. She was voted into the Commons on the 17th of April. On the 19th of April, there were riots in Londonderry. Riots weakened the already weak position of Captain Terence O'Neill, the Prime Minister, undermined by a split in his cabinet. On the 28th of April, he resigned the party leadership.
To those of you who have so loyally supported me, who in times of trouble have sent me countless letters, telegrams and other messages, I want to say this. Do not be dismayed. What you and I were trying to do together was right. Morally right, politically right, right for our country and all who seek to live in peace within it. What is now impossible for me may be, I do not know, easier for someone else.
And indeed, the liberal impetus which Captain O'Neill had given affairs outlasted his term of office. The new Prime Minister was Major James Chichester Clark.
My position on one man, one vote is perfectly clear. The parliamentary party decided that last week that one man, one vote would be given in 1971 or at the next local government election. The House of Commons confirmed it. And as far as I'm concerned, there is no going back.
But Irishmen have long memories. In July, when the Protestants celebrated their 17th century victory at the Battle of the Boyne, riots broke out in Londonderry. In August, the apprentice boys marched through Derry to mark the end of the city's great siege in 1689, and they marched back into the miseries and hatreds of the past. That same day, on into the night and through the next day, there were vicious riots which spread across the six counties. The mobs used petrol bombs, the police tear gas. Finally, British troops, in the background since April, were sent into the barricaded streets among the shattered buildings and burnt-out homes. It began to look as if Northern Ireland might have to be ruled direct from London. And amazingly, the troops did the trick, at least for a time. Being soldiers, they looked on the bright side.
Oh, it's not too bad, you know. Getting out kept. It's warm in here.
Have you been on this sort of job anywhere else before? We've done internal security in Aden, but it's nothing like this. It's different. Didn't expect it, not from the British Isles, like, you know.
How do you find people are when you're on the barricades? Are they friendly?
They're very friendly. Bring you a pot of tea, cakes. They give you cigarettes.
But the general commanding all the troops in Northern Ireland wasn't quite so optimistic.
The honeymoon period cannot, I do not think, continue forever, obviously. We're perhaps at the peak now, where everybody's smiling and swapping cups of tea and all this sort of business and cracking jokes. But unless there is a solution or some hope for the future, and this is where the politicians have got to come in, the soldiers are not going to be welcomed on the streets for forever and ever.
Within a few days, a politician did come from Westminster, the Home Secretary, Mr. Callaghan, and if he had no instant solution, at least his advice was sound.
I'm not here to dictate to the Northern Ireland government. I've come here to help. I can't solve your problems. Only you can decide whether you are willing to live at peace with one another, in freedom, in equality, and without discrimination.
In all our minds, the space story is crystallized in those moments when Neil Armstrong stepped from Apollo 11 onto the moon at 3:56 a.m. British Standard Time on the 21st of July. We have forgotten that only a few months before, it was still a race for who should get to the moon first. We've forgotten the days in January when the Russians could well have been ahead.
This is Radio Moscow. The Soviet Union this morning launched another manned spacecraft, Soyuz 5. The commander of the spacecraft is Lieutenant Colonel Boris Volinov. As soon as the spacecraft was in orbit, Commander Volinov established two-way radio communication with the Earth and with the spacecraft Soyuz 4 launched yesterday morning.
But the Americans approached their operations with a little less solemnity.
Hey, while you're eating your lunch there, I might read to you what the astrologers say about your day. This is for both Jim and Dave. You must learn to listen well. Don't get into any disagreements today. And group activity is preferable tonight.
Well, we'll try. We'll try, Ron.
Okay.
Hey, is three considered a group?
Stand by. This is Rusty's. Be selective in choosing your friends. Get any new scheme moving promptly.
I got a new scheme moving promptly this morning.
Okay.
That was Apollo 9, which orbited the Earth in March as a dress rehearsal for the moon flight in July. After they landed on the moon, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin peered through the windows of the lunar module, and this is what they saw.
Now, we'll get to the details of what's around here, but it looks like a collection of just about every variety of shape, angularity, granularity, but every variety of rock you could find. The color is, it varies pretty much depending on how you're looking relative to the zero phase point. There doesn't appear to be too much of a general color at all. However, it looks as though some of the rocks and boulders, of which there are quite a few in the near area, looks as though they're going to have some interesting colors to them, over.
And then the moment the world had been waiting for, what has been described as the most momentous event in man's history.
I'm at the foot of the ladder. The limb footbeds are only depressed in the surface about 1 or 2 inches, although the surface appears to be very, very fine-grained as you get close to it. It's almost like a powder. Ground mass is very fine. I'm going to step off the limb now. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. Yes, the surface is fine and powdery. I can pick it up loosely with my toe.
it does adhere to, in fine layers, like powdered charcoal, to the sole and insides of my boots. I only go in a small fraction of an inch, maybe an eighth of an inch, but I can see the footprints of my boots and the treads and the fine sandy particles. There seems to be no difficulty in moving around as we suspected. Okay, Buzz, we ready to bring down the camera?
Apollo 11 proved that the Americans could get to the moon. Apollo 12 enabled them to start exploring it, and it was during that next Apollo flight in November that some light was thrown on why the Russians had lost the race. They'd had a cataclysmic accident with their new super booster rocket, a story that was broken by the American magazine Aviation Week. Here's its editor, Robert Holtz.
Well, we got onto it by working back from the mystery of what went wrong with the Soyuz 6, 7, and 8 mission. And when we finally fitted the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle together, it became apparent that there had been some rather catastrophic failure with their booster.
So what does it all add up to? Robert Holtz again.
We have 8 more Apollo missions, each one of which will involve a longer stay time on the moon and will be aimed at exploring increasingly interesting portions of the moon. I think the next extension beyond that is the establishment of a permanent scientific base on the moon.
Early in this great year of American achievement, Richard Milhouse Nixon was inaugurated 37th President of the United States of America.
I have taken an oath today in the presence of God and my countrymen to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States. And to that oath, I now add this sacred commitment. I shall concentrate my office, my energies, and all the wisdom I can summon to the cause of peace among nations.
As a first step, he announced that in February he'd be leaving on a tour of the Western European capitals. In the space of 1 week, he landed in Brussels, London, Berlin, Bonn, Rome, Paris, and back to Rome. But it was on television that President Nixon made most of his major policy speeches on Vietnam. The first was on the 15th of May, when he outlined proposals for peace.
As soon as agreement can be reached, all non-South Vietnamese forces would begin withdrawals from South Vietnam. Over a period of 12 months, by agreed-upon stages, the major portions of all U.S., Allied, and other non-South Vietnamese forces would be withdrawn. At the end of this 12-month period, the remaining U.S., Allied, and other non-South Vietnamese forces would move into designated base areas and would not engage in combat operations.
In June, Nixon took things a stage further when he announced the withdrawal of 25,000 American troops. Then he set off again on his travels right round the world. The purpose of this tour, he said, was to develop a new policy in Southeast Asia which would avoid direct United States involvement in any future Vietnam-type conflicts. Self-help was the theme of most of his speeches, but his allies in Southeast Asia didn't seem too enthusiastic about the idea. The Thai Foreign Minister, Thanat Koman.
Some of our friends here in this part of the world used to call it a striptease show. The lady, South Vietnam, keeps on shedding one piece of clothing after another, but the other side keeps watching and waiting for the final moment when all the clothing will be shed and that South Vietnam will stand completely naked.
And when that moment came, this was what they feared.
If and when Western nations should decide to withdraw, either completely or partially from this part of the world, the Soviet Union should be able to fill the vacuum or the gap created by such withdrawal.
The president was rebuked, but he continued his tour, and on the way home, he stopped off in Romania. It proved far and away the gayest part of the whole tour, and he ended up dancing in the streets with local girls, much to the delight of the Romanians and the photographers.
Here in this country, in which we have entirely different political philosophy from our own, people were out by the hundreds of thousands, not ordered by their government, but cheering and shouting, not against anybody, but simply showing their affection and friendship for the people of the United States.
But back home, in spite of more announcements about troop withdrawals and cuts in the armed services, the public was getting restless with Nixon's Vietnam policy. On October the 15th, it was openly challenged for the first time, not just by the students and the doves, but by a growing number of ordinary Americans tired of the killing in Vietnam. Millions joined in marches, demonstrations, and church services calling for withdrawal now. In New York, a roll call of the names of the war dead was read aloud.
Michael Charles DeLacy, Hayward Dennis Jr.
Senator George McGovern summed up the spirit and the mood of the American desire for a moratorium.
We are not engaged in this moratorium effort in a desire to break the president, but in fact to lift the terrible burden of war from his shoulders and from the shoulders of the American people. There is only one way to do that, and that is to accelerate the pace of withdrawal from what is now clearly a hopeless conflict.
The moratorium was an enormous success, and a death march was planned a month later. Some commentators thought that this may have influenced the timing of Nixon's next important announcement on the Vietnam War. It took place on the 4th of November, and in it, he appealed to what he called the great silent majority of my fellow Americans for national unity and support. He refused to commit himself to a timetable for withdrawing American troops, and he said,
"If the level of infiltration or our casualties increase while we are trying to scale down the fighting, it will be the result of a conscious decision by the enemy. Hanoi could make no greater mistake than to assume that an increase in violence will be to its advantage. If I conclude that increased enemy action jeopardizes our remaining forces in Vietnam, I shall not hesitate to take strong and effective measures to deal with that situation."
Undeterred, the death marchers went on marching. All 250,000 of them, in single file, passed the capital. Then came Pinkville, the GI name for the village of My Lai, where American soldiers revealed that 18 months before, they had killed old men, women, and children.
There was about 40, 45 people that we gathered in we all huddled them up, made them squat down, and Lieutenant Kallick stepped back about 10, 15 feet, and he started shooting them. And he told me to start shooting. So I started shooting. I fired about four clicks into the group. I might have killed about 10, 15 of them, men, women, and children. I felt like I was doing the right thing.
One of the president's great critics over the way the war was being run was Senator Edward Kennedy, who seemed all set to follow his brother to the White House, or at the very least to be heading for the Democratic nomination for 1972. Then, one night in July, he drove his car off a bridge on Chappaquiddick Island in Massachusetts and drowned his female passenger. The local police chief, Mr. Dominic Arena, was one of the first on the scene.
We got a listing, a registration listing on the plates on the car, and found this time that it belonged to Senator Kennedy. But we made calls to try and locate the senator, and when one call went to my station, it was learned at that time that the senator was there. So I went over there, and then the senator told me that he had been the operator. He had been over at Chappaquiddick and had been heading back for the ferry. There's a small ferry that runs between Chappaquiddick and Edgartown, and that he had made the wrong turn. And as he hit the bridge, he evidently catapulted off the bridge, spun over, and landed in the water.
But, he added,
there is one problem, and that is that the senator did not show up until 9 o'clock in the morning at my office, and the accident supposedly happened sometime between 12 and 1 a.m.
Senator Kennedy's passenger was 29-year-old Mary Jo Kopechne, his brother Robert's former secretary. Immediately, the press began to buzz with speculation. On the 25th of July, Kennedy felt bound to answer some of it.
There is no truth, no truth whatever, to the widely circulated suspicions of immoral conduct that have been leveled at my behavior and hers regarding that evening. There has never been a private relationship between us of any kind, nor was I driving under the influence of liquor.
He spoke of his state of mind at the time.
All kinds of scrambled thoughts, all of them confused, some of them irrational, many of them which I cannot recall, and some of which I would not have seriously entertained under normal circumstances went through my mind during this period. They were reflected in the various inexplicable, inconsistent, and inconclusive things I said and did, whether some awful curse did actually hang over all the Kennedys.
Perhaps we should be thankful that our own head of state and her family sit well above the dust of the political arena. But this year we were allowed, more than ever before, to see them as human beings. They even found themselves short of money.
We go into the red, I think, next year. Which is not bad housekeeping, if you come to think of it. Inevitably, if nothing happens, we shall either have to, we may have to move into smaller premises, who knows? We had a small yacht which we had to sell, and I shall probably have to give up polo fairly soon, things like that.
By now, we knew exactly what things like that meant. A joint BBC-ITV documentary had taken millions of television viewers behind the scenes of Britain's royal family.
Buckingham Palace? Who's speaking, Peter? Your Majesty, would it be convenient to speak with Mr. Shelley, please? Thank you, Your Majesty.
But the year really belonged to the younger royal generation. Prince Charles, cheerfully facing the run-up to his investiture as Prince of Wales, recalled in an interview with Jack DeManio a visit to Cardiff, where he faced a crowd of angry Welsh nationalists, which he did with considerable good humour, if you remember.
I had slight butterflies as I walked up, but I just went to see what it was these people really were getting at. I thought, one could talk to them as perfectly ordinary people. And somehow I feel that because they're demonstrating, they're a group apart, somehow, in the sort of modern ghastly phenomenon. So I asked one chap who was holding a placard what it was it meant, and he, in fact, hurled abuse at me and said I was go home, Charlie, or something like that. So after I'd asked him more questions, I gave up. It was no point.
And then, on a showery 1st of July, the prince, even more gallantly, faced the protracted formalities of his investiture as Prince of Wales.
I know that social conditions have changed since 50 years ago, and, of course, are still changing. The demands on a Prince of Wales have altered. But I am determined to serve and to try as best I can to live up to those demands, whatever they might be in the rather uncertain future.